It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says schools need to consider the needs of students with disabilities when they're coming up with their active shooter plans. First, the Justice Department is directing its Inspector General to look into a claim by President Trump that the FBI spied on his 2016 campaign. Trump called for the investigation of the agency in a tweet over the weekend. He also said he wants to know whether such surveillance originated from the Obama administration. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who oversees Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe, added that if anyone infiltrated the campaign for inappropriate purposes, quote, we need to know about it and take appropriate action, end quote. The latest developments follow a report last week that a retired American professor, a longtime U.S. intelligence source who's assisted with the Russia investigation, had contacts with three Trump advisors during the 2016 campaign. But there is no evidence to suggest that an intelligence source was embedded within the campaign, as the president has suggested. Devlin Barrett is the national security reporter with the Washington Post. Devlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob.
Let's start with this concept of an informer, an FBI informer, as the president says, spying on his campaign. What do we know about this person?
Well, they're a source. They're someone who has provided information to the FBI for a number of years, and they're a professor. And they what we're told happened is during the 2016 election, this person essentially initiated, brushed up in a number of meetings with then-Trump campaign advisors. And, you know, that is a piece of investigative tradecraft. That is a piece of intelligence tradecraft. But Trump and his supporters are arguing that's very nefarious and suspicious, and they want to know more about it.
This is something that you can imagine the FBI doing in a normal, everyday kind of investigation. The stakes are higher, though, when a presidential campaign is involved. What do we know about the process of what they'd have to do to be able to use, to get approval to use an informant like this for kind of a sensitive target?
Well, the real issue isn't so much the use of the informant, because that's used at the very beginning of a lot of different types of cases that the FBI does. In fact, under the FBI's own rules, they can use an informant or a confidential human source before they've formally opened a full investigation on a person. I think what's different here is as you said, just the political implications of it, the possibility of being, as they are now, being attacked for having done this, and the idea that they are now on the defensive in some way to try and defend how this went down.
And this is this informant, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes, has been seeking info about the informant from the Justice Department. How does that work? There's questions being raised. Well, this guy is an informant. It could endanger him if his identity is released, if too much information is released. What's the role of Congress here?
Well, so Congress obviously would like to know as much as it can about what the FBI is doing as far as this investigation goes. But there is a basic principle that goes on in government that Congress should not interfere too much with FBI criminal investigations when those investigations are still ongoing. And that's really where a lot of the friction here comes from, the fact that the FBI wants to complete its work on the Russia probe before providing this kind of information to Congress. The other issue that's a really big one, frankly, is the FBI and the Justice Department and, frankly, other intelligence agencies are very concerned that if this information is turned over to Chairman Nunes the way he has asked, that it will leak out and that it will endanger the source or it will endanger the people that the source has worked with in the past. And that's a concern for a lot of folks involved in this. And those are the reasons why you're seeing so much tension and friction on this point.
Can you talk about what the president appears to be requesting from the Justice Department in these tweets versus what the Justice Department seems to be doing in response, referring this to the Inspector General?
Sure. So the president on Sunday sent out a tweet saying he was going to issue an order essentially instructing the Justice Department to investigate whether someone infiltrated or implanted themselves with his campaign. Just to be clear, that would not be an accurate description of what we understand this particular FBI source did. So it's a little bit of an odd question in the sense that the Justice Department's immediate answer might just be, well, no, that didn't happen. But what the Justice Department did was they released a statement saying, obviously, that's an important question, and we will have the Justice Department's Inspector General look at it, because the Inspector General is already looking at a number of these types of issues. So it's not so much opening the door as it is, you know, taking a door that's already open and just opening it a little wider, frankly. But obviously, this is all alarming to some folks, current and former justice officials especially, who think the president is basically interfering with the administration of justice, and that alarms them.
Talking to Devlin Barrett, national security reporter with the Washington Post, on the latest on the president, his tweets calling for an investigation of the Department of Justice over the investigation of his campaign in the 2016 election campaign. Devlin, let's talk about the independence of the Department of Justice. You just mentioned that people are concerned about the president kind of giving these direct marching orders here. How hands-off are presidents usually in this kind of situation, if we can say this kind of situation, if there are parallels
right
out there?
It's a little unique, but generally speaking, it is very true to say that presidents tend to be very hands-off on this. Although a lot of presidents don't have a perfect record on this score. You know, when, for example, President Obama offered the opinion in a public interview during the Clinton investigation that she did nothing wrong, that there wasn't any criminal responsibility there, you know, that definitely angered and frustrated the folks at FBI and the Justice Department. But those were sort of little flashes and blips in the process. What you're seeing now is a long-running argument and a fairly tense one between the Justice Department writ large and the president and his supporters. And that's a difference of scale in terms of those past issues and the current one.
One question people have brought up is, what happens if President Trump directly says, hey, Rod Rosenstein, turn over these files on this informant to these members of Congress? What would Rosenstein's options be?
Well, that's a great question, because just this afternoon, actually a few minutes ago, the president wrapped up a meeting face-to-face with Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Wray, and the head of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And we're still working on figuring out what exactly was said in that meeting. But if that order were to come, our understanding has been that the Justice Department, senior Justice Department officials, don't think they could follow such an order. It's not clear to me that sort of order is going to be issued. But if it were, you know, people talk about, you know, the truly bad outcomes here, which would be, you know, if that order was refused, would the president then fire someone or fire more than one person? Those are the scenarios, those are the worst case scenarios that could play out if it came to that. But, you know, this has been percolating along for a few weeks now, and it hasn't come to that. So I don't want to leave the misimpression that that is definitely where this is headed, because I think it's still an unknown.
There's a lot of twists and turns, obviously, in this investigation. Can you talk about the piece of the Russia probe that this informant and the people he talked to, three Trump campaign officials, what part of the story is this delving into here?
It's really about the beginning, the early days of the Russia investigation. So you're talking the summer and fall of 2016. And what appears to be happening at that time period is this source, this FBI source, is arranging meetings and arranging conversations with folks involved in the Trump campaign's foreign policy area. And he seems to be finding ways to, you know, be friendly with them, have meetings with them, talk about foreign policy with them. So nothing super untoward on the surface, but it does raise a lot of suspicions among Republicans, and it does raise some interesting questions as to exactly how the FBI decided to first start trying to answer some of the questions it had about possible contacts between Trump advisors and Russians.
And this is all going on with this concept in the backdrop that the president might or might not talk to the Mueller team himself personally. And Rudy Giuliani is saying something about if he can do this, then maybe they wrap up the probe by September. What do we know in the ongoing quest to bring President Trump to sit down with investigators?
Well, it's funny. I think this is one where you see a ton of rhetoric about the desire to have such an interview, but it also feels like the two sides are moving further away the more time goes by. And, you know, there are a bunch of different reasons for that, but essentially Trump seems to be, the president and his lawyer seem to be getting more combative on the subject of an interview, on the topic of an interview, and putting more conditions on their agreeing to an interview, which normally is an indicator, you know, for lawyers that, you know, this is probably not going to happen. Having said that, Mueller and his team would very much like to do the interview because obviously one of the big questions in all this is what was the president's intent? What did he mean to do when he did certain things? And that is a huge part of the law, showing intent. And obviously the best, so one of the best ways to find out someone's intent is to ask them.
We'll leave it there. Devlin, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Devlin Barrett, national security reporter with the Washington Post, talking about President Trump's call to investigate the FBI, he says, for allegedly spying on his campaign. First, Wisconsin lawmakers passed a $100 million school safety grant package in April following the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. The state's Department of Justice is accepting applications for the funding, and Wisconsin schools are examining their safety procedures. But some advocates are concerned that students with physical and mental disabilities aren't being taken into consideration when schools develop their safety plans for active shooter situations. Sally Flashberger is the lead advocacy specialist for Disability Rights Wisconsin. Sally, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you about this topic.
Let's talk about these active shooter drills. Do schools pay enough attention to students with various kinds of disabilities when they're coming up with these plans, these active shooter plans?
So we have not seen too many very specific to students with disabilities. I have done some research, and the state does offer some on their website, some resources for Safe School, but even just looking at those, some of them are really old and they don't really talk about active shooter situations. And I know it has definitely been in the news lately, and with some of the school safety bills that came forward, that was a concern for our agency of whether students with disabilities are being considered in these safety plans.
One of the typical plans for active shooters in programs around the country, really, is the idea of run, hide, and fight as the kind of the steps that students and teachers can take. How does this leave out many students with disabilities, physical or other disabilities?
Right. So I think we think about students with physical disabilities first who maybe are using wheelchairs or walkers or have some type of limitation where they really wouldn't maybe even be able to run for sure, but even be able to hide. And I think about the professionals that are working with them, and sometimes there may be a group of kids that is in a classroom, and think about how is that person going to protect someone who's immobile and maybe not able to help themselves at all to even hide, and thinking about that. I think we also think about kids who maybe have sensory issues where in a situation of an active shooter where they may need to be quiet, there may be alarms going off, it may be scary, you know, they may be in a more fight or flight mode, and they may actually flee, but not in a safe manner, and or they may vocalize just due to what's going on around them, and so how do we keep those kids safe, and how will their teachers keep them safe from some intruder in a school?
Yeah, that category of disability includes so many different students. Is the answer maybe not these specific guidelines from on high, but something as part of the individualized education plan that a student might have so that a school can tailor a response to the needs of the actual students who are there?
I do think that would be important for parents to be thinking about that and discussing that, and for schools to be thinking about it, because if you don't have the conversation, you may be planning just with the regular protocols, but having that conversation at least brings it light to a team of people and what they're going to do for those individual students. I think we often see schools do that when they're talking about fire. You know, there's certain protocols that fire departments have about possibly where kids go who have a physical disability. If they can't get downstairs, they may be waiting in a certain area. So I think the same types of things need to be done, and there needs to be individual safety plans for students with disabilities. But I think also, too, schools just need to recognize that even in some of these dramatic situations, if those plans can't be followed, what are going to be the contingencies and what support is there for those professionals so that they're able to keep the kids safe? Because I think that's a great burden on our teachers and administrators in schools. So thinking about what could be an overall plan, talking with the police departments, and thinking about how we're going to keep all kids safe.
You mentioned fire drills, and are there other lessons and precedents we could take from schools doing fire drills for years and figuring out how to meet the needs of students with disabilities?
Yes, I do think so. I think that we definitely see with fire drills, like one example is, you know, kids might know ahead of time who maybe do have sensory issues that the fire alarm's going to go off. And so I think for sure when we come to drills, we can take some of those same principles. I think it's when we're planning, if something were to actually happen, you know, what is going to keep those kids safe. But I think it really starts with a conversation. And I think that's what's important for parents to be thinking about. And maybe, you know, talking to their local school districts as they're starting to develop these plans. So, you know, we have this new the whole package of school safety bills that was passed. And I think that is an opportunity for parents to work with their local school districts on a plan.
Sally Flashberger is with us from Disability Rights Wisconsin. And Sally, that that new legislation you just mentioned and this grant application program, $100 million for school safety upgrades, what role did your organization play, if any, in that legislation and in this grant process?
We did participate at a hearing, so the recommendations had come out from the governor, and it did go through a hearing process. We did testify at the hearing. We had really asked for some more increases for mental health treatment that are already part of school funding, and then some of the recommendations that Dr. Evers, the state superintendent for schools, had put forward about climate, which included some areas of bullying prevention and positive behavior interventions. The hearing process was very quick. They had one hearing. In the midst of that hearing, it seems as though the Assembly and the Senate came to an agreement about what this package would look like, and then it was passed very quickly with not too many significant changes. As part of our testimony, we did ask that as part of school safety plans that there would be a provision added to the bill that would require schools to have a plan for students with disabilities. So that did not get in there. Currently, we are considering reaching out to DOJ, but they have not assigned the person who's necessarily in charge of these grants yet to just kind of talk to them about students with disabilities and maybe what they can be looking for as people start to apply for these grants, or really even consulting with school districts to just maybe remind them that that would be an important part of the plan. I think some of the issues around the funding is a lot of it may go to more structural changes and not to more programmatic changes that that I think even school districts were hoping that they would be able to be looking at some of the supports and services that students might need to possibly eliminate even the risk of some of these issues happening at school.
I want to bring up the role of first responders and reading up on this in actual active shooter situations. Police are instructing kids as they evacuate to come out with their hands up, which makes sense, make sure that somebody isn't armed on the way out. An issue I hadn't thought of, though, is that some students with disabilities might physically be unable to comply with that. They might, especially in a situation, a very stressful, obviously, situation, people with some conditions might not be able to understand or kind of comprehend that instruction in the midst of all of this. Is it important for first responders to have training in these kind of issues?
I do think that's important, and some of the research I've done, different organizations have come out with information. There is, DPI does have on their website some information from the Autism Society for First Responders. So each individual police department really handles that all individually. So it really, it's a local decision about what type of training they might have. And I think definitely we've seen some that are doing that and becoming aware. But again, in a crisis situation, right, do we know that they have this information? That's a very interesting thought about raising their hands. I myself have a young adult with a disability who is my son, and he cannot raise both his hands. And, you know, I also think about kids who may be running, or a lot of kids have a fight or flight mode, you know, when a situation like this happens, and you'd hate to see a student be running out of a building without their hands up and police not being sure, you know, who is that, you know. So I do think it's important that first responders be thinking about this, and I think that, you know, it can be very different around the state. So again, it might be another area where the Department of Justice could really be focusing on, you know, what are the strategies that departments need to have around this.
And I want to ask for your advice for maybe parents, families listening. There is a student with disabilities. What can the parents, what can the student themselves, for that matter, do to advocate, to take these issues to their teachers, their school district, and make sure there is a plan in place?
So I think now is a really important time because these plans are being developed. So if districts are going to be asking for grant dollars, they're developing some type of plan. And I would have to imagine that most districts are going to submit to get a portion of this funding. So I think parents can reach out to their local school districts, whether that's through the superintendent or their local school board. But I think now is the time because this grant cycle is definitely happening. And even if their school isn't going to possibly apply for some of the funding, I still think it's an important discussion to have. And I think definitely starting with maybe their special ed director and then their superintendent, and then maybe looking at their board members, because I think it will be a local decision how these plans are put in place.
Sally, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great, thank you.
Sally Flashberger is the lead advocacy specialist for Disability Rights Wisconsin. She joins us to talk about how schools can meet the needs of students with disabilities in their safety plans. First, is feeling nostalgia good for us? It turns out the answer to that question might depend on the kind of nostalgia you experience. And our next guest says that in recent decades, a more harmful kind of nostalgia has been making a comeback. Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. And she recently wrote about the idea of the nostalgia trap for the Harvard Business Review. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, I think a lot of us think of nostalgia as a mostly harmless kind of pastime, and you write that sometimes it is. What kind of nostalgia is not such a big problem?
Well, you know, I think there's a huge difference between the kind of nostalgia most of us feel, which is really like the tendency to remember the best parts of an experience and want to recapture those, or to recapture a feeling that we had with others. And that's something that can be very, very healthy. But there's another kind of nostalgia, and actually the word nostalgia comes from when this was much more prevalent in the world than it has been until recently. And that's the kind of nostalgia that wants to recapture, that first of all, thinks that the good feelings were there all the time for everyone, or at least everyone in the group, and thinks that instead of making you feel warm the way healthy nostalgia does and recreate those feelings, not only sustaining old relationships but reaching out to new ones, the unhealthy kind of nostalgia is when you say, I don't want new ones, and I've lost this connection to my old group or my old society or my old era, and somebody took it away from me. And that's the kind of nostalgia that leads to depression. It leads to hostility toward outsiders, and it helps produce conspiracy theories about who took this away from us.
So it would be phrased something like, Era X, whenever we want to say, was the good old days. Things worked well then. Something went wrong between then and now. That's kind of the basic idea?
Well, you know, let me be clear. There, as you said right at the beginning, there are some kinds of nostalgia that are healthy. I mean, personally, the kind of nostalgia that makes you want to reconnect with people, you want to recapture good feelings, you want to sustain good feelings. That's a great kind of nostalgia, particularly if you don't think that the entire time, you don't romanticize the bad times of them. But this idea is more than just looking back. I mean, I think there's a kind of good social nostalgia, too, that says, what are the best things in our past that we could build upon? The unhealthy kind comes when you think there was one period in which everybody was doing well, or my group was doing well, and it was doing well because there were no other groups involved. And since then, that golden eggs has been taken away from us by outsiders, by invaders, by the deep state, by whatever it is you decide is the villain. And that's the kind of nostalgia that's kind of pathological. And, you know, back in the 17th and 18th and 19th century, that was very common among people. And, in fact, doctors were really, really worried about it. Then that receded as modernization went on and people said, oh, there are some things that are good about social change. We'll embrace those, and we will not try to turn the clock back.
Are we seeing a rise of this negative nostalgia in recent years?
I think we are. I think we are. And, you know, a lot of people have talked about that. It's common. It was most common, I think, among conservatives until recently, but now you see it among liberals as well. You know, liberals are saying, well, you know, there was a time when Democrats and Republicans liked Planned Parenthood, or there was a time when there was civil discord and bipartisanship. And that kind of nostalgia also rewrites some of the past. The fact that Planned Parenthood was often not available to blacks, black women or poor women. The fact that that bipartisanship led to all sorts of dangerous and unfair invasions of other countries. But you also see it a lot among conservatives who think, well, if we could just get back to 1950s families, to 1950s economy. Now, where I depart from some of the most common analyses of what's wrong with this nostalgia, and we can go into it because I'm a historian and I can tell you that the 50s was not all that it was not a Leave It to Beaver era for most families. But let me say that the other side of it is today the kind of nostalgia we're seeing is, I think, been exacerbated on two sides. One, by the people who absolutely deny the problems that there were in the 50s and 60s and just say if we could get back to that, we would be fine. But I think it's also been exacerbated by the kind of modernists and some liberals and technological people are really, I think, at fault in this, who have denied the uneven nature of the progress that we've made and the fact that it has led to loss for some people. So somewhere in between, you have to be able to say, let's take the parts of nostalgia that say there are things we can build on from the past. They're not always what people say they are, but we can't go back to it. We shouldn't go back to it. There were too many things wrong with it that we wouldn't want to live there. But let's figure out how we can move forward in a way that recognizes the trade-offs and minimizes them.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz, professor of family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, talking about nostalgia, good nostalgia, and what she sees as potentially bad nostalgia when we have kind of false impressions of what the past was and use that in a negative way today. Stephanie, we heard from Jace, who wrote on Facebook, I think the large amount of people who say the good old days are looking and concentrating on nostalgia and personal experience, not looking at the general whole. My grandparents' childhoods are going to be very different reality than the childhood of a person of color in that same era. So let's take that 1950s you mentioned and break it down with Jace's thoughts in mind.
Yeah, and I think that he gets absolutely the two-sidedness that I was talking about. There were some things in the 50s that I understand why many people are nostalgic for. For example, if you look at what was happening to working people in America, working class people without a college education, the gap between what they earned and college-educated people earned was much less than it was. There was not the same sense There was real protection for working people. There were unions, there were regulations. It was harder for companies to outsource or to engage in financial speculation that rewards stockholders with the results of workers' productivity rather than increases in wage raises. They weren't able to outsource to other countries or to subcontract to people without unions or pensions. So there was a steady period from 1947 to 1979 when every generation of young men, and this includes black and Latino men, although they were way, way, way behind their white counterparts, was making economic progress and were earning more than their fathers had at the same age. So you can see why some people are nostalgic for this. Here's the problem. First, they're nostalgic for the wrong reasons. It wasn't because America excluded blacks and Latinos. In fact, we did better once we started letting those groups into the unions and expanding the leverage of working people. And it certainly wasn't because the families were so much better. I mean, family domestic violence was much higher in the 50s and 60s, in white families as well. You know, if it was infanticide was much higher. If you were black or a woman, you were at the bottom of the line. You know, in legal rights, in blacks were the last fired. Women couldn't even take out a credit card in their own name. Domestic violence was not taken seriously. Rape was defined in every state of the union as forcible sexual intercourse with someone other than your wife, because a wife was expected to submit. So this was a period where if you were white, if you had a father who didn't abuse his legal and socially acceptable customs of beating up on his wife or on you, if your mother was really happy, as so many women were not, with her very limited options, then it seemed like a pretty good place, at least in comparison to the Depression and World War II. But boy, if you weren't, you had no options. Blacks and Hispanics, massive three-day race riots if they tried to move into better housing. All sorts of prejudices, still lynchings going on. And if you were a woman who was abused, no such thing as a shelter for you. So it was one of those things where it's so easy to pick and choose the good parts and forget what was happening to the other people.
Stephanie Kuntz is with us, professor of family studies at Evergreen State College. We're talking about what she calls the nostalgia trap. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a time that you think of as the good old days in the United States? Or are you suspicious when people talk about the good old days, that something's being left out? Do you agree with our guests that nostalgia can cloud our view of history and our present-day conditions in turn? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Stephanie Kuntz about her recent piece in the Harvard Business Review about the benefits and drawbacks of nostalgia and her concerns about falling into what she calls the nostalgia trap. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a time in American history as the good old days? Do you feel like your community, like the country, has changed in ways you don't like? Do you wish you could go back to those good old days, whatever and whenever they were? Or are you suspicious when people start talking about the good old days? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers. Stacy is with us in Oak Creek. Stacy, hi.
Hi, I really like that your historian and your speaker pointed this out. I've often thought the way she is thinking. If the days were so good, Betty Friedan would never have written The Feminine Mystique. And we can't just cherry pick. And so I really appreciate her point of view and that she's sharing it. So thank you.
Stacy, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, Stacy used the phrase cherry pick, and that's part of what you're worried about. It sounds like that we pick out the very best things that we remember and just leave out all the rest of the stuff.
Exactly. And you know, I don't want to put anybody down for having good memories. You know, when I first started talking about this, you know, you'd get calls from people who said, my family was great. And I'd say, okay, but, you know, what did you know about the families in the black neighborhood or the white poor neighborhood? And, you know, and I understand some nostalgia, you know. One of my favorite memories as a kid is when my mother walked down to the library in a rage because this very mean librarian had refused to let me check out this book of Mice and Men, for heaven's sakes, you know, but it had swear words in it. And she said, you know, the librarian had berated me for trying to take this out. My mother marched in like a little banty hen and said, you let my child check out anything she wants to. I trust her implicitly. Well, by the time my son was a teenager, I was not willing to walk into any video store and say, you let him check out anything he wants. So, you know, I can understand that kind of nostalgia, but it's just like your caller said, it's cherry-picking, because it's the same period in which women had really no recourse. You know, there were only 8 states. People talk about how great it was when there were homemaker wives. There were only 8 states in the union where a wife who stayed home, had put her husband through school, supported all of his job, had any claim on the income that he earned outside the job. The only way she could get it was if she could prove that he'd been at fault and had wronged her. So if she couldn't prove adultery that she had not participated in, you had to come to court in those days, quote, with clean hands, or that he had abused her but that she'd never fought back, she got nothing out of it. So that was the other side of these good memories.
Stacy, thanks for that call. Stephanie, how does it, before we go back to our callers, how does it hurt us today if we get the past wrong, if we fall into this nostalgia trap? Okay, maybe we get the 1950s wrong. Does that affect us in the 20-teens?
I think that it affects us tremendously. And one of the reasons it affects us tremendously is because there are some bad things going on today. Since 1980, every generation of young men aged 25 to 30 has earned less in real dollars than their fathers did at the same age. And that's particularly true of whites. Whites still earn more than blacks and Hispanics, considerably more, and they have much more wealth. But they've been experienced losses that I understand, you know, and mostly we judge ourselves by our trajectory. So they're feeling upset about that. There's much more inequality in this society, economic inequality, not as much, quite as much racial inequality, and not certainly not as much gender inequality. But there is much more economic wealth inequality than there was when in the 60s and 70s, every expansion, the bottom 90% got the majority of the benefits of the income growth, whereas today, it's the top 10% and 1% who do. So there are real things that people have to worry about. But if you start thinking the way to change those is to go back to the 1950s and forget about what the differences were, for example, the fact that women were excluded from the workforce, and even more importantly, the fact that there were so many things that are exactly the opposite of what the Make America Great Agains are telling us. We had more government subsidies of families, more investment in jobs, more protections for unions, more regulations of banks. So even when you deny the real progress we've made, and we've made tremendous progress since the 1950s, there's less poverty now. Elders were so much more likely to be poor in the 50s and 60s than they are today. But even when you actually look at the problems we have today, we're going to get the solutions wrong if we try to solve those problems by rolling back the clock.
Talking to Stephanie Kutz from Evergreen State University, Evergreen State College in Washington. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Minocqua. Mike, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just was wondering what your guest thinks of nostalgia therapy in people with cognitive problems, cognitive loss.
Mike, thanks for the call. Stephanie, we've talked about that on the show, where people with dementia often benefit from nostalgia. But that's more the personal stuff you're talking about earlier. It might be the music or the sports or things like that that they remember. You have no problems with that, I think.
Well, no, of course not. And of course not, you're not going to take my mom had Alzheimer's, and I know how important it was in calming to her to think about the good times in her life. But precisely because she had dementia and precisely because we could not go back, we didn't have to remind her of the bad things. You know, the time that her father, who was often a wonderful father, was drinking too much and mom kicked him out of the home. So we could remind her just of the good things, and that calmed her down, and it was a great thing. But that's very different from thinking that, you know, making it a political program to take us back to an era that already has cherry-picked memories.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We heard on Facebook from Ted, although I was not alive yet, based on TV shows of the times, the late 1950s and early 60s, get my vote for the good old days. Can you talk about how TV shows were representing the 1950s and 60s to people at the time, maybe not even matching the reality then?
Not at all. I mean, Leave It to Beaver was just not a documentary. You know, it's kind of interesting if you look at those TV shows. You should also look, of course, at the news with the riots, the dogs sicked upon children, and demonstrators in the South. But if you look at the comedy TV shows, they weren't the way things really were. They were extended advertisements for a new consumer economy in which the age of marriage, after all of the hardships of the war and the postponements of having babies during the war and the hardships of the Depression, new families were forming at a tremendous rate. The age of marriage for women was less than 21. The GI Bill was giving benefits to 40% of young men so that they could actually afford to start families. And so there was this real interest in starting families, and the new expanding consumer economy started to really romanticize those families. And in some ways, these sitcoms were extended advertisements for, if you'll buy this house, if you'll buy this refrigerator, you too can have a family where mom and dad will never fight the way that, you know, actually they were fighting in many families, even as these TV shows were going on. Certainly the way that people were fighting the Depression, big increase in divorce rates immediately following the war when these early marriages fell apart. And so it's like, you know, the beer ads that say, if you drink this beer, the Swedish bikini team will come hang out at your place. They were saying, buy this refrigerator. Ozzie and Harriet always schmoozed in front of Hot Point appliances. The kids were never shown drinking things that weren't for sale in the ads. And essentially they were aspirational. They were not documentaries. They were not realistic. And my mother once described to me watching them and thinking, oh, gosh, you know, wow, I never knew you could have that kind of a freezer. Oh, my goodness, this is a washing machine. That would save me a lot of work, you know. But she didn't have any of those things. And it became associated in her mind that if she had that kind of family, if she built that kind of family life, she should get those sort of things. The flip side of the coin, and this is really important if you didn't live through the time to know, is that so many kids, and I've taken oral histories, hundreds of them over the years, would watch those shows and think, what's wrong with my family, my
and
mom?
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Stephanie Kuntz from Evergreen State College in Washington, author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. About a week ago, I shared the most popular baby names of 2017. They were Liam and Emma, but you're thinking, that's human names. What about the cats? Okay, you probably weren't thinking about that, but we stumbled across a list of the most popular cat names by state based on a pet insurance company's database. The number one cat name here in Wisconsin was Sophie. It's up against a lot of other states with Bella as the number one cat name. So what about dogs? Well, the number one dog name in Wisconsin is, well, Bella, like the cats in the other states. So I start following all this down the rabbit hole on the internet, and no, I didn't look for rabbit names. But hang on, that cat name list, it was just put up over the last week on a website that I never heard of. I tracked down the original data. It's from 2015. The dog names, 2014. Who knows what's changed since then, and I can't find any newer state breakdowns. So I'm sorry, I don't have the latest data on cat and dog names in Wisconsin, but we can get real scientific now. Take a few seconds and send us the name of your pet and what kind of pet it is. Ready? Email it to ideas@WPR.org right now or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Kind of pet, pet name, go. Looking forward to hearing about it. And if you share them, maybe I'll share your pet's name right here on the radio. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.